We are a nonprofit founded in 2018, dedicated to using pack goats to provide outdoor, or what we call mountain therapy, to veterans and first responders.
They're smart animals. They're crafty. And to this day, we have no idea how they got out of those pits.
It never crossed my mind that could be like a huge thing that was therapeutic for you, doing those same activities but not being forced to do them. Welcome back to another episode of Wildlife Outdoors, guys. We have a very exciting guest today. Luckily, we were able to schedule it. This is our first interview actually during the middle of the day, so we're able to get this going. But today, we're going to go ahead and welcome Casey Brewster. He is a conservation biologist, a postdoc research associate at the University of Arkansas, and a professor at Northwest Arkansas Community College. So welcome, Casey. How you doing, man?
Man, I'm doing really good. I'm excited to chat with y'all. This is going to be good interview, I think
it's gonna be fun. It's a little different because we're interviewing you on something that I'd never even heard of before. And so we have a mutual friend, Steven, and he was telling me that you go out on hiking trips, hunting trips, fishing trips, but with pack goats. Like, I've never even heard of that. How did that even come about?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So really, the as far as like why I chose pack goats and why I went down that route, I've always liked goats. I had a nickname of the goat while I was in the military for a short time period that came after the Adam Sandler skits on the goat. Mm-hmm. Do y'all remember that?
Yeah.
And so, those dirty skits. And so I always liked goats. And then and I was interested in doing something kind of revolving around sort of what our main theme is, outdoor therapy and whatnot. But I had no clue that I would include goats. And then one of my close friends sent me some YouTube videos, texted to me, like, you like goats, you're into goats, dude, you know about pack goats? And I'm like, pack goats? I'm like, what? My goats, at that time were really tiny. And so I look at these videos, these elk hunters out west with these giant goats. And I'm like, oh my God, dude, that is me. That is, I've got to do this. So, like, I don't know, within 3 days, I'd conned my wife in to letting me go find a couple of future big goats. They were babies at the time, but I mean, they were going to be huge goats, and started packing with them or hiking with them. You can't pack with them until they're much older, but started hiking with them and fell in love with it. And then sort of, without giving too many things away on how the project sort of went, ultimately led to the nonprofit itself. So
yeah. That's awesome. And so speak on that nonprofit. I see you got a shirt on that says Snake Mountain Pack Goats.
Yes, that's us. So we are a nonprofit founded in 2018, dedicated to using pack goats to provide outdoor, or what we call mountain therapy, to veterans and first responders. It's always free for the veterans and first responders. And sort of, so the main mission is usually from a Friday morning to a Sunday afternoon. We meet up, we hike into backcountry areas in the Ozarks and the Ouachitas, a handful of different places that we go. We set up a base camp, and then we'll do whatever activity. So fishing, hunting, hiking. We do a lot of workshops. Here recently, we've started doing a lot of workshops. So a lot of different things. And then we pack out on Sunday. We do one of those a month throughout the year. Every now and then we'll pull off two, but it's tough for me and our schedule to do that. Mm-hmm. And sort of, with the main overarching theme of this mountain therapy to veterans and first responders.
That's awesome. And I know personally, just from my experience, that it's very therapeutic being outdoors, but I've never really experienced anything where animals are involved like that. And I know animals are therapeutic on their own. I mean, goats have their own personalities, and there's goat yoga out there and all sorts of different ways that people use animals for therapy. Have you noticed a big difference between recreating outdoors and recreating outdoors with goats?
Yes, absolutely. I think so. Some of it was on purpose. Now the goats, the goat idea really stumbled in and just sort of like put the icing on the cake and was above and beyond. But the main idea behind the project originally was that I wanted to do something that the things that helped me through PTSD, I believed in, right? And I think a lot of us recognize, whether you've had PTSD or not, that just these are things that help you stabilize your life, make you feel better. They're things that we need as men and or women, to kind of help, our headspace. And the main ones that helped me with PTSD was the outdoors. You know, just really, really getting outdoors and remembering the things that I love to do, and that so many different things outside, you know, within that, being active, getting your butt off the couch. And, you know, a lot of veterans were at one time considered athletes, and a whole lot of them, a handful of years after getting out there, they wouldn't call themselves athletes anymore, you know? And so sort of just regardless of what it is, being active. And because we hike out there, we're not riding mules. There's an active component. And it can be relatively challenging sometimes on purpose, not too much, but a little bit of, you know. And then the brotherhood, or, you know, the partnership, sitting around and talking about hunting stories and fishing stories and what they love about the outdoors, what conservation means to them, or what, you know, what is going on with, you know, some lady they got to deal with at work, whatever it is, just that campfire mentality, which is in a lot of ways what a podcast, you know, sort of, you know, kind of is just kind of sort of talking about life and experiences and different things. But that, you know, a lot of times we don't recognize how, important that can be to helping, you know, some folks' well-being. A lot of guys, you know, they get in this work regime and they've got a couple of people they work with, but outside of that, they don't have like-minded folks that they can sit around and chat about. It doesn't have to be woe is me stuff. 99% of the time it's not, you know, sometimes that is important. But then the last thing, the icing on the cake, was the dang, the animal therapeutic nature of it, which I've always been an animal person. I've always been huge in animals. I'm definitely an animal lover in all different walks, and, you know, whether it's snakes or lizards or beetles or goats or you name it, and dogs. But the animal side of it, the therapeutic nature, therapeutic aspect of goats, really was surprised a whole lot of rough and tumble, you know, Army Ranger comes out and like, yeah, we're going to eat the goat at noon today. And, you know, on the way home, on the way back out, they're like, can you send me a postcard with Ranger's picture on it? You know, fall in love with the goats. And so all of it combined, going back to your original question, I do feel in all different levels and all different ways, we see lots of signs of it making positive impacts in ourselves. I mean, the staff associated with myself, we get as much out of it as anybody. I mean, this is sort of most of our sort of side hobbies. And so we get a ton out of it, but we definitely see everything from guys just being reminded of the things that they love to do, how important some of those things for them. Whether they make big changes in their life or not, probably, you know, with one weekend, maybe it doesn't have a huge impact, but we've also seen huge impacts. We've seen, you know, people that lost weight, you know, after coming and seeing us, so that on the next trip, they're in better shape and they are in better shape and becoming more active, getting some things, you know, some of their headspace squared back away. We've gotten people way, way more back into the outdoors than what they used to be. You know, what do they call it? Late onset hunting. We've caused some folks to get into hunting that weren't into hunting, you know, before. So lots of different things. And really, I could see a little bit of that. Hope Stephen doesn't mind me saying it, but I think Stephen didn't have a huge background in hunting, but his first trip was a turkey hunt, and which we weren't successful with him. But I think that had a huge impact on him thinking, wow, there really is something to this. Maybe, you know, you don't have to grow up being taught this. You can learn this later on and really enjoy it. So,
yeah, when he was on our podcast, he talked a little bit about that, about how he didn't grow up hunting, and his first kind of foray into hunting was actually squirrels that were eating his fruit trees in Houston. Yep. So he wasn't really big and growing up in it, but he seems like he really enjoys it now. But I didn't know that y'all had gone on a turkey hunt with his first trip with y'all. That's pretty cool to know.
Yeah, turkey hunt, and then even we sort of set him up to have a chance at a DIY bear hunt, which was going to be tough. I mean, like you could be the best hunter in the world and, you know, struggle there. So it wasn't probably the best way for him to learn that. But I think the turkey hunt, he did enjoy, because we did hear some birds and we got to walk around and see some really pretty country. And I think you could see the wheels spinning. That's sort of how that works. And a lot of times, you know, they got to be successful within, you know, a first handful of hunts. Otherwise you'll be like, well, why are we even doing this? But otherwise, yeah, I definitely can see some of that with him. So
That's awesome. So you talked a little bit about the goats and their personalities and stuff like that. So there's one goat in specific when I was, you know, looking at your channel and stuff like that, that the name came up a few times. So can you tell us a little bit about your goat, Juan?
Yes, Juan. So Juan is originally the first two pack goats that I got was Juan and Pablo. And my son's named Juan and Pablo. You notice that the rest of my goat string, for the most part, are all military names, but the first two, my son's named, and so those names stuck. You know, when your boys name an animal, you just go with it. But I named my first two goats Juan and Pablo, and they were, when I first brought them home, they weren't very tame, but I saw their mom and their dad, and they were huge, and you know, that's one thing that you need to have is big goats. So I was excited about them. Got him tamed down and everything else. We lost Pablo. He got in the grain shed. Actually, a handful of them did, and he didn't make it. He got foundered. But anyways, so then after him, well, so they were both pretty good pack goats, but after then, Juan really kind of came in his own. Not that he, you know, needed to get away from his brother or anything, but Juan has sort of been the kind of poster child. Every time we go to events, we've had kids on him and taking pictures. So many people are like, I've never seen a goat that big. I didn't know goats could get that big. And he's just, you know, he really is the number one, Juan. We call him Juan, of the goat herd. And now if we're going uphill for a long period of time, he doesn't lead the pack string because he is a little thick. And his cardio will start going down and he'll let some of the other goats pass him. If, you know, as long as it, you know, we're not going too fast or anything like that. Yeah. He doesn't let anyone pass him. He's big Papa Bear and everyone else in the goat string knows it. So that's awesome.
Yeah. I saw a couple of guys talking about him saying that they're his favorite goat. And I even saw a little clip of him getting down on his knees to eat.
Yes. Yes. That goofy goat. He'll go straight down on his front legs on his knees. And yeah, just to get after any extra little morsel. Oh, there's one piece of corn down here I got to get. So he didn't get that big by being picky, and he is not picky. No.
Yeah, that's awesome.
He's a little boy. Yeah.
Jose used to have goats when he was younger.
Yeah, they were punks though, man. Dude, I'll tell you what, goats are crafty. We
yes, they are.
There's a research ranch we go out to, and they have multi-species grazing. They have cattle, sheep, and goats. And we have GPS collars on the few animals. And every now and again, we'll have to go out there. We're out to corral them, round them up, remove the collars, download the data, and then put them back on and everything. So we were out there one day, and the goats are pretty food-oriented, so they're not – if they're feeling cooperative, they don't give us too much of a hard time. We can get them pinned up in like an hour or so. Once we find them, finding them is a hard part. Because it's like a 5,000 acre ranch. I mean, we just got to drive around until we find them. And every now and again, we'll get lucky. They're like by the gate or whatever. But found these goats, and then they happen to be close to these older pens. God knows how old those pens are, but they're pretty, they've seen some years. They've seen better days. So we got them pinned up there, and it was a fiasco. It took us probably 3 hours to get them in there. And so we still had to track down the cattle. I think the sheep were off the ranch at this point, so we didn't have to worry about them. So we got them pinned up. We're like, we'll deal with them when we finish the cattle. We found the cattle. We got them all wrapped up in like an hour or so. Went back to the pens, and we see all the goats walking down the road. There's just one little lone goat sitting in the middle of the pen. We're like, what the hell? And so we tried, man. We went around. We could not figure out how they got out. All the gates were shut. There were no visible holes in the fences, like in the pens, like nothing. They were just gone. And so we were at that point of the day, we were done, man. We were so frustrated. So we just left. And luckily in the morning, they were pretty close to where we had left them, where we had last seen them. So again, we were able to round them up. This time they knew what was going on. So they fought us a little harder. It took us about 3.5-4 hours to get them back in the pens. But dude, it was a mess. I like goats, but I'm also not a fan because of how much of a pain they can be. Because they're smart animals. They're crafty, and to this day, we have no idea how they got out of those pens.
Yeah, they're really good at figuring out ways to get in places that you don't want them. And, you know, most of the time, like my goats, they're never going to go far, but they, I have had to become a master at mending, finding issues with fencing constantly. Everything from, I've got two Lamanchas that are really tall. They're about 200 pounds, but they're tall and lanky, and they can clear a little over 5 foot pretty easily. Like it's nothing.
That's crazy.
And which is a pain in the butt. You know, most of us don't fence it above 5 foot, you know, usually between 4 and 5 foot. And so your T-posts aren't the right size. Your fencing isn't the right size. So you're putting barbed wire up and getting extra T-posts. It's a huge pain. And then really the reason why I lost Juan's brother was because one of the Lamanchas figured out how to open up a side latch, you know, that you have to go up sideways and then down and then pull on the door. He figured that out, opened it up, but he wasn't the biggest goat Juan and Pablo were. So they kicked his butt out of there and they ate most of the grain. And that, I mean, I almost lost five of them, but, they ate, I don't even know how much, probably 50 pounds of grain at once.
Oh, wow.
So stupid. Yeah, they will. That's another thing. In a lot of ways, I'll say goats are way smarter than people realize, but in that one aspect, they're not. They'll eat enough to kill them.
I mean, I don't know. I tend to engorge myself when it comes to food.
So. Yeah, this is true. Yeah, they'll try to hurt themselves. So ding dongs. You definitely got to keep an eye on any potential things. Of course, getting on vehicles. And I've got some Nigerian dwarfs that I use for outreach, which are, you know, tiny little goats.
Yeah.
And even those little goats, man, they can jump on a four-wheel drive pickup truck and be on the cab and, you know, in blink of an eye.
That's crazy.
To climb up that stuff. So
yeah, I've seen goats on like roofs of houses, and I mean, you can find them freaking everywhere.
Yep.
It never ceases to amaze me on the places they can end up in trees. You know, you go down to South Texas, you'll be driving through and they'll be up in some, you know, weesach or some oak trees down there, just kind of hanging out on a sideways limb. It's like, okay. It's like the leaves probably taste better up there.
Yeah, they're really good at climbing, which, you know, for pack goating, it really helps. You know, that's one thing is people ask, you know, where can you take them? And the question is, or the reality of it is anywhere you can go without rappelling equipment, the goats are not going to have any issue.
That's awesome.
So you don't have to fight to take them pretty much anywhere. Water now, you know, if you in Arkansas, we deal with a lot of river crossings, you know, kind of year round, you know, the Ozarks and the Washtenaws are just, there's streams everywhere, and goats notoriously don't like water. So I start out all of my young ones in the summer, I'll go wade fishing and just take them with me. And before too long, they have no choice but to cross the river, you know, 700 times. And by then, they're swimming and they don't care. But a lot of folks, you know, like out west, I've posted videos of some of my goats swimming across a stream. And they're just, you know, these folks out in Colorado, they're just mind blown because they can't even get their goats to go over a puddle. You know, that's sort of their mentality. And it's because, you know, in Arkansas, we're constantly dealing with water, rain, and take them wade fishing, man. That's the way to do it.
That makes sense. So in the process of taming them, is that something where you just kind of take them out and do what they're going to be doing and force them to do it? And, you know, over time they just get used to it, or what's that whole process of taking a baby goat and making them ready for going out?
So the biggest, they're way easier to train than probably 90% of people would ever recognize them. Most of the stuff you really need them to do, it comes to them naturally. The first step is they just have to be tame. If they've been bottle fed, they're already tame. You know, there's nothing to them. If they're not bottle fed, then while they're younger, they usually, a couple months after they come off mom and they're weaned, a handful of months, they'll be kind of halfway tame. And then there'll be a couple of months there where you got to watch them because they'll start getting where they just don't like people as much. Not all, but a whole lot of dam raised goats will. And during that time, you just want to make sure that, you know, you never get mad at them and kick at them or do anything to really ruin that trust, and try to, you know, spend some time with them. If you can see them at least 10 minutes every day, that helps a ton. And by the time they're, you know, 6 months old, they're usually calm back down and kind of come back around. And then once they're tame, then it's super easy. I could take, you know, if you have a friend that has goats at their house, it's never left the farm, but they're tame, I could load them up with my goats and I promise you I could take them all over the mountains and they're not going to have any issue. Because really? Goats follow you better than one of the biggest reasons why they're about the best pack animal, in my opinion, obviously I'm biased, hugely biased, but nonetheless, is because they naturally follow you. You know, just about every other pack animal, you know, one out of four, one out of five, like does not want to follow you, or they just go through spells where they won't listen. Goats are going to follow you. You cannot leave your goat. As long as he's tame, they're going to follow you naturally. It's in their DNA to just follow the leader. They don't want to be the last goat, so they'll fight. They'll keep shuffling on who's right behind you, and you got to try to keep them from passing you. They'll try to pass you if they think that you know where you're going. They don't want to be wolf bait, so they don't want to be last. But you kind of get that out of them, and they follow you really easily. So the first step is, you know, the harder parts is getting them to load up in a trailer, unload from the trailer. You know, sitting on a leash or hanging out on a leash. Cause you know, when you get to camp, you're going to leash them up, and at night you're going to leash them up. There's a lot of different situations, you know, where you might need to leash them. So you leash train them, but they're way easier to leash train than a dog. Their instinct isn't to go exploring and pulling on that leash and everything else. Their instinct is once they learn that they can't pull away from the leash, their instinct is, well, let's just walk wherever, I guess wherever we're going, that's where we're going. So, most of it's easy. About one of the hardest things to teach pack goats is to have camp manners, because you'll be over there, feet, you know, kicked up by the fire, eating dinner, drinking a beer, whatever you're doing, and next thing you know, there's a goat in your tent, you know, eating a sleeping bag, and because they're tame, right? They love you and they want to be around you, and if you're not paying attention, they can tear up camp really quick. So that can be an art. There's lots of different techniques. I have a little dog that I hunt with that's also trained to kind of help keep the goats back. He'll go dive bombing at the goats, kind of push them back. You can squirt bottle them out of camp. And then once they get to be two or three, they usually learn it, and they're pretty good about staying out of camp. Although Juan every now and then will just decide he's going to come in and flop right down next to the campfire. And if he's not getting in trouble, I'll let him slide. But usually he's just waiting for that opportunity when you're not paying attention, so he can get into the bag of tortillas or, you know, whatever. So
so is it true that goats will really eat basically anything?
It's not true. Yeah, that's one of the big misconceptions. They will eat. Now, they will eat just about any type of plant matter that has ever been made. Cardboard boxes. They will literally eat it. And so we talk about this in one of the classes I teach when we're talking about enzymes and digestion, but they actually can get energy. They're getting some energetic calories, not a lot, but a little bit of calories out of paper and cardboard because it's cellulose, and they can break that down into a small amount of calories. Probably not good to just feed your goat copious amounts of cardboard, but nonetheless, it's not hurting them. They'll eat leaves, and then, you know, just about any plant out there, they eat bark, a lot of different bark, but everything revolves around plant matter. Outside of that, you know, if it's fat based, or if it's protein, you know, if it's meat, they're pretty much not going to touch it. And then where they can have problems is like cushions and seat cushions on a motorcycle, four wheeler, tractor, anything out there. They just like chewing on it, just like a puppy or whatever. And so they'll get on there and start nibbling and tearing it up. And people, you know, they'll get called out for eating that or whatever. They test a lot of things with their mouth, you know, so you might see one like nibble the side of a beer can laying on the side of it. You know, mine don't, because they've been out there enough, but you kind of get the idea. So I think that's where that mentality comes from.
I see. That makes sense. So you've talked a little bit about, you know, your teaching and stuff like that. And so what subject do you teach? Do you teach biology?
I do. I teach, I mainly teach intro biology classes. I've taught some anatomy, some physiology. This next semester I'm teaching introduction to conservation biology. Pretty excited about that class. But most everything goes back to biology. I'm the subject area coordinator, which means that like I have to make decisions on which textbook and what you know directions the classes go, and make sure that all of our biology classes look pretty similar and meet the standards or whatever. So I'm pretty heavy on the biology side. Yeah,
that's awesome. And so that kind of goes along with what you know your PhD is in, isn't it?
Yes. It definitely fits my background. That's why a lot of the, you know, I'm excited about that intro biology class. So the last chapter in my intro biology class is the chapter that's termed conservation biology. And it's sort of my capstone lecture. You know, that last lecture, I've got a really cool video that Forest Service and TNC sort of filmed that talks about conservation and lizards and glades and whatnot. And then, you know, so the chapter does this, and I sort of follow the same thing, but the first section of the first half of the chapter is a lot of bad news, a lot of doom and gloom, you know, this sort of how conservation, there's a lot of negative things out there when we're talking about climate change and loss of species and, you know, all these other things. But then the second half of the chapter is about the things that we're doing to improve that, one things that we can do and different concepts that relate around that. And so you kind of get to sprinkle some of the happiness in it. And then at the end of this semester, well, I'm selling all the students. You need now, if that was fun, take intro to conservation biology. So we'll see. Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome. So you mentioned glades. So didn't you do a podcast with the Ozark Podcast guys talking about glades?
Yes, we did. Yes. Kyle and Kyle.
Yeah, the Kyles.
The Kyles. That was a fun podcast. They had been interested in glades and not necessarily just collared lizards, but they knew a little bit about collared lizards and they knew a little bit about this and that. And so it was sort of a perfect time. And when they reached out to me, they're like, man, you haven't done like a glade podcast. Why don't you do a glade podcast around that? So the reason why my background's heavy with glades is because the model species that I did my dissertation on, their primary habitat are glades. And so I've had to become pretty acquainted with and learn a lot about. And then most of my conservation work that I do now revolves around that glade habitat, restoring it and improving it. So
I see. That's awesome. Yeah. I was one of those guys that I didn't know what a glade was prior to that episode. You know, I would just think glade, oh, Everglades, you know, that's the first thing that came to mind. So yeah. I actually learned a lot from that episode, and we don't got to go into that because you've already done a whole podcast on it. But for those of y'all that are listening, it's a very interesting listen. So go check out the Ozark podcast, listen to his episode. You'll learn a lot. So you do a lot of stuff and have done a lot of research in biology. So Jose is kind of in the midst of doing the same thing. And you talked about field work before we got on the podcast. So what does your field work typically look like?
So most of the stuff that I do nowadays is going to revolve around, population assessments on eastern collared lizards. And so I'll go and look at, so I've got some populations that we have reintroduced. And so I've got to assess that population. How much recruitment do we have this year? How many adults from the previous year left behind are, you know, still there? So sort of aspects around that. So that's going to be a whole lot of it. And then I also work in a molecular ecology lab. And so tied with this collared lizard project is keeping track of sort of population structure, how much gene flow there is, how much migration there is, which individuals seem to have more offspring, have better recruitment success, because that relates back to where their source was from. So I'm reintroducing them from another place or from a captive propagation program that we have in Central Arkansas, the Little Rock Zoo, where they have some lizards. So we're keeping track of a lot of those different things. So I'm getting toe tissue samples, moving some lizards around, getting, if it's a new habitat site, sort of assessing how close are we to being able to reintroduce this one, making assessments for the land manager and recommendations, you know, hey, I think we're real close. We need another fire on the ground. And you know, in the next year or two, we might be able to reintroduce lizards, you know, that kind of thing. So
that's awesome. So what's the process of taking lizards that were raised in captivity and releasing them in the wild. And I ask this because when I was younger, I used to capture a lot of green anoles, and I would catch them in my backyard, keep them in a tank for a while. And at one point they started breeding, which I guess that means that I was, you know, creating a nice habitat for them inside. But I started getting too many of them, so I started releasing them back outside. And I always wondered, like, are they surviving? Is it possible they're surviving? Because I never like hand fed them or anything like that. I would, you know, put mealworms and crickets and let them find their own food. But I just wasn't sure how successful they would be if they're born or raised in captivity and then reintroduced outside.
Yeah. So in general, it's going to be very species specific, but painting with a broad brush, animals that are born in captivity have lower survival rates once they are released into the wild. I mean, it's just the nature of it. I'm sure there's exceptions to that, but on average. And we suspect, I don't have enough data right now to really pinpoint how different it is, but we suspect that, the lizards that are bred from captivity are not going to have the survival rates, not going to have, be quite as robust, but they are still surviving. And the biggest thing, when you think about, what you're trying to do, what we're trying to do is get a much higher survival rate in captivity with the amount of, let's say we have two females and let's say on average they would have, 30 eggs apiece. Well, in the wild, out of those 30 eggs, probably one or two from each individual would make it to be a yearling that next year. Well, we can supplement that. We can get that close to 100%. So it gives us a whole bunch of lizards. Now, are they going to have the survival rate that those other lizards that were born in the wild have? Almost never. No. I mean, probably not even half. But even if you had a quarter of that, that would still be out of 60 lizards. You still got 15 of them instead of just the two. And so sort of the idea is be able to throw a larger number, even if you're going to lose more at these sites. And then we also will follow it up. The following year, we'll go ahead and grab some wild caught animals, a handful of wild caught animals. That gives those that originally came from captivity a chance to find a territory and sort of sort out who's going to make it through the next year. If they make it through that first year, they're probably going to be in pretty good shape. And then when you bring in the more sort of redneck, tougher, the ones that have been around the block a few times with a scar on their eye and whatnot, they're going to kick their butts. Now they've got a puncher's chance. And hopefully you can kind of keep a stable starting point for that population. And then if that takes on, well, then, with lizards, just like a lot of, smaller, shorter generation time animals, if you can get them sort of started and stabilized, they usually do fine. Take off.
I see.
That's kind of how that dynamic is. Yeah.
That's awesome. So if you take captive bred lizards and they're interacting and commingling with wild lizards, is that something where, and I don't know how it works with instinct and how things go with predation. So obviously if they're in captivity, they're not going to have as much of an issue with predation as, obviously on the wild. Is that something that they can learn from the lizards that were, wild born? Or is that kind of an instinctual thing?
I think it's more of an instinctual thing. And I think with, a species like this, I don't think they're going to learn or teach any of the others. It'd be cool if they would,
Right.
I think they really learn, about predators and how to survive. And it's in the first 2 weeks, if they make it past those first 2 weeks, they're probably in pretty good shape. But in the first 2 weeks, if they sit there and have a delayed response when a hawk comes in, then they're food and they're done. Right. And there's no more learning. They learned. And then it's over.
they don't survive.
But I think once they get past that, then they have enough instincts and if they're getting enough food, which, in this system, food is not a limiting factor. They've got more food than they could ever. It's all about not getting, eaten in the process of getting that food, making sure you find the right place to spend the night so that critters don't get you. And overwintering, is a big one. Is do they go to the, when the winter hits, they've got to get below the frost line. And we put them in a habitat that has all the things they need, but I'm not telling them and showing them where they each one needs to go. And I think we probably lose some that just because they weren't born in that habitat. And, you know, because like you think from where they hatched from, if they were a wild lizard, from where they hatched from, if they went there for the winter, they'd probably be fine, right? Yeah. But these animals don't know that for sure. So we don't know what cues tell them. And so we wonder if we may lose some that just pick the wrong spot to try to overwinter. Yeah. But again, we're still getting reasonable survival rates over, you know, that first year, higher than I anticipated originally, which suggests to me that there's enough instincts there that they kind of pick up on it, you know. So
that's so cool. So we kind of got off the rails. You know, we talked a little bit about how we're probably going to do that in this podcast. So I guess we'll kind of get back to the Snake Mountain pack goats. So you spoke earlier saying that you suffered from PTSD. Did you serve?
Yes, I served in Iraq in 03, 04, and then again in 07, 08.
Okay. So, well, first of all, thank you for your service. You know, we're big supporters of the military. And so is that something that kind of also made you want to do more for the community of veterans?
Yes, I think the whole reason why I started the Pat Goat Project again, you know, initially, or the main thing was well, let me back up. So I struggled quite a bit when we came back from overseas, like 90% of veterans. And then of course, you know, like a lot of folks, whether they served or not, you know, you go through your early mid 20s and it's like trying to just solve life, you know, in today's day and age, it's very similar, at least on that, in that level. And what things that I got through it, right? I had different things that helped me get through it. I ended up going to school, I ended up being working on my PhD, getting a hold of my life, you know, getting away from some bad habits and improving things. And then and looking back, you know, 10, 12, 15 years down the road, what were the things that helped? And it was that outdoor therapy, that mountain therapy, being active and those type of things. But also I had served with a couple of different organizations, actually rode with a motorcycle club that served veterans. I liked riding motorcycles and in some ways that fit me. It had the brotherhood, it had serving other veterans, and shoot, it's hard to beat riding a motorcycle with a bunch of other cool guys. You
know? Yeah.
But it didn't have the you know, being active, it didn't have the outdoors, it didn't have the mountain therapy. So it was still not, it wasn't everything I wanted. So when I stopped doing that, I realized I still wanted to serve veterans in some capacity. I still wanted to show folks some of the things that helped me get through my hard times and the things that helped me. Cause you know, a lot of my brothers, you know, struggled, you know, and maybe took longer to kind of get out of that or still aren't, you know, out of that slump, you know, to be honest, you know, everybody's different and the different levels on that. And this mountain therapy model won't help everybody. Absolutely. You know, some folks, it's just not their thing, but I think a whole lot more it will help than even, I think a lot of times one of the biggest things that tells me it's working is when somebody comes out and it's just, they recognize these are the things that they used to do that they appreciated, even though we don't love getting up at 3 a.m. to go do push-ups outside and do, you know, military stuff and go living out in the dang swamps and, you know, being in the woods all the time and being active and all these other things, even though at the time it didn't seem like that was so important to you. When you sort of kind of go back into it and you're in control of it and do it as you like it and how you want, a lot of guys realize, wow, yeah, I do like that. And that does help me. And that gives them something to show their kids and to, you know, to have camaraderie, some other brothers, some different friends that they might not have, a new connection that they have, and just sort of fills a whole lot of niches from, you know, that therapeutic side. So
that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it's one thing that I never even really thought about. Like, I know that obviously going out and doing stuff, and there's different forms of therapy, you know, for people that have suffered and suffer from PTSD. But I never thought about the fact that you were forced to do it before, so there's automatically going to be that resistance. But doing the same thing under your own power, I didn't think that would, you know, it never crossed my mind that could be like a huge thing that was therapeutic for you, doing those same activities but not being forced to do them. So
yes, yeah, I think a really good example is I think there's a lot of veterans that would tell you they don't love going to the range. The military has a way of making the range miserable. And yeah. I was one of those that most of the time I went to the range, I didn't enjoy it. It was no fun. You're being yelled at. You're in line. It took all day long to make 50 shots. I mean, there's just so many different things they would do to that making the range time no fun, right?
Yeah.
And I think there's probably a lot of vets kicking around that have no desire to have firearms and don't go back into shoot. Most do, right? We reckon. But there's still, I think there's a fraction that don't, just because they're like, I was so miserable on the range. I don't ever want to do that again. I don't want to sit behind. And, you know, it's like, it's hard to imagine. But whenever now you're in charge of it and you do it how you want to, and you remember some of the things that you were taught that are ingrained in you that makes you pretty darn skilled, regardless of your background. You're probably pretty darn skilled at marksman. Those guys, you know, then it is sort of that full circle where you realize, okay, it's pretty cool. And I think that applies to a lot of different things that we do that fits with, you know, from the therapeutic side.
So what does the process look like when y'all go on a trip? So you mentioned earlier you bring the goats on a trailer. And so do you just have everything packed up, unload the goats, load up the goats, and just hit the trail? Or how does that work?
Yeah, so the groups really vary a lot. The number of people, anywhere from 5 to 6 to 14 or 15, you know, people that were taken. And so we have to get our weight together for all the goats and the amount of gear. Cause we're going to almost glamp, they call it glamping or car camping, you know, sort of, you know, we'll, the goats can carry a lot of extra stuff. So we're going to eat really good meals, campfire meals. A guy named, Doc James is our, camp cook, and he's got an experience like doing outdoor wild game meals around the campfire for dinners and breakfasts. And so we might be carrying 80 to 150, I think one time 160 pounds of food, you know, that the goats were carrying. Right. So, get all the food stored away, get everything, make sure that we're not missing anything, and then load all the goat saddlebags. I usually will do it the weekend before, cause I'm usually working all the way up to Friday. Mm-hmm. When we go to leave, get all that loaded up, everything set aside besides the foods, keep that in the freezer, load it up Friday morning, get that all loaded in. And then we clown car the goats into, a horse trailer. When I say clown car, anybody that messes with pack goats knows that's how they prefer to be hauled. so a 2-horse, trailer can easily hold 10 goats. I mean, that's how they like to load up. They ride better. They can just stand there and kind of lean on each other as you go around corners and whatnot. So you clown car them into the back of the truck and then get to the trailhead. Well, with us, we'll do a convoy briefing, a safety briefing, you know, have folks, you know, make sure they have all the gear they need there at the farm before we leave, and then load the goats up, head out there. And it does take probably a good 20 minutes, 25 minutes to get all the goats' saddles on, all their bags on, everything set up. And then from there, we hike in anywhere from 2 to 5 miles, 6 miles is about the farthest we usually ever go back in there. Set up base camp and then do whatever activities we got set aside for that trip.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So you're talking about the cooking wild game. I saw a video earlier of y'all making some bear burgers.
Yes.
How are those?
Oh, dude, bear burgers are legit. No, they're really good. Yeah.
I've only ever had bear in a stew, and it was really good, but it also had sandhill crane in it. So, you know, I couldn't really tell between the two. I just know that whatever was in the stew was amazing.
It was good stuff. Yeah. There's a lot of things out there that are surprisingly good. Bobcat is really good.
Really?
Yeah, it's surprisingly good. I've had bobcat chili and coyote chili. I've had bobcat and coyote chili, and I couldn't tell the difference. I had just enough bobcat to know the bobcat's good. The coyote, I don't know. It still tasted good with the bobcat and all the other stuff that was in there. Yeah. Water buffalo, elk, deer, bear, lots of squirrel, rabbit. There's not too many things that we haven't tried.
That's
and,
awesome.
Dude, like, this guy can make anything taste good. So I have to like take it with a grain of salt. Like maybe I don't want to go shoot a coyote and like, you know, put it in the freezer myself, but if he does it and somehow it's good, man. So Yeah, he's really good at what he does. And we do fish tacos. So one of our, when we first started out, one of our sort of potential, this project really started, we founded the nonprofit, but we didn't know exactly how the model would be, kind of what I've described, Friday morning to Sunday. And we have one base camp, we don't move. But we didn't know exactly how this would look. We didn't even know that for sure. And, we had a lot of different ideas. And one of our first ideas was we're going to bring some food out to camp, but we're not going to bring enough. And we're going to force people to catch the fish, needed to make fish tacos. And they're going to kill the squirrels or whatever it is, right? You're going to eat. You've got to go harvest. And you can see it's a pretty cool idea. That sounds great. Sounds like a great idea. Until you don't get the amount of food. Yeah. And then you're way out in the middle of nowhere. Everybody's starving. So we did that. I think the first two or three times we did where our main meals were going to be fish tacos or something fish, we had no issue. We caught fish, no problem. But I think about the third or fourth time, we had a group of 13 of us and the fish were not biting and we were really struggling to get fish. And dude, I was filleting like little sunfish that were like an inch and a quarter long, like trying to get filleted. Dude, I was filleting any, like people would bring some of them, like, it's kind of a fish, I'll fillet it, Hand me that salamander. Dude, we're trying to get some protein in that. And we probably had enough to feed like two people and we split it between like 13 of us. And then after that, we're like, maybe that part of the project isn't that important. Maybe there's other ways of doing this.
Yeah.
So, since then we bring in our food, the amount of food we need. So,
Do y'all still hunt and fish though, to where y'all can harvest what y'all catch, but it's not a necessity?
Yes. Yeah. Essentially that's how we do it now is, we'll plan aside, meals so that, if we, and bring the fixings to do, like say we do kill a mess of squirrels. We have squirrels tonight. Because we did, and we'll just save that other food, which is a much better model, much better model. And same thing with fish tacos and you name it. Now, usually if we harvest a bear, we're out all night long just trying to get, all of that taken care of because it's always hot in Arkansas during early bear season. Yeah. And, we don't plan on eating, anything that we kill, during like bear season. Usually early deer season is not that way. But some of the season, we'll go ahead and have both. So
that's awesome. I think I'm going to go on a bear hunt and film a bear hunt September this year. And I'm super excited for that. I've had an unofficial invite and, so we'll see how that pans out, but I've never been bear hunting, but I'm excited just to be a part of the experience and help out. And bears themselves are just magnificent creatures. And I've had it, like I said, in a stew. And the guy that said I can go with him said if he does harvest one that he'll let me have some of the meat. And I'm just excited to try it different ways. I'm super excited for that. But he was telling me when the season is. It's like early September. I was like, it can still be kind of hot.
It's hot. Oh, yeah, it's hot. But it's a lot of fun. I mean, even if we never harvest anything, I just love, everything that goes revolves around, sort of scouting for them and getting, you get pictures of bears, man. It's, it's pretty legit. Get them on the cell camera and, sitting there at the house board and you're like, well, I wonder what Baloo is doing today. Oh, yeah, he's there at the bait right now. Just all the things that go in with bear is awesome. It's not about, it's a little bit different. You're there trying to harvest one. Mm-hmm. But it's not like deer season where if you don't, it's a bust, and it's not like fishing or a lot of other things. Like there's a lot of people that will, have never killed a bear and may never kill one or kill one, I've killed one, and so it's not something that you're going to a lot of numbers on, but if you can still fall in love with everything else that goes within it, it's a really fun sport. So.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people get addicted to the experience, whether they harvest one or not.
Yeah. Just seeing them is enough for me. I mean, people run around the woods, like just in Arkansas, in the Ozarks, and hike all the time and everything else, and have never seen a bear,
Yep.
So, of course, I've had the privilege and been able to see several, but it's still, you know, it's, I'm doing things specifically to try to put myself in position to be able to see one. And it's usually, you know, they're gone just as fast as you saw them. So,
yeah. I've only ever seen one. I was driving to Camden, for the nature of my work. I have systems in Camden and White County and East Arkansas, all over Arkansas and, Tahlequah, Oklahoma, Vicksburg, Mississippi, Longview, Texas. So I go all over the place. And I was going to our Camden system one time and I'm driving and it was probably like 6 o'clock in the morning. Sun was still behind the trees. And I'm driving and I see something crossing the road up there. And I slow down. I was like, oh, it's just a dog. And I was like, that's a funny looking dog. And I get closer. It's like a 200-pound black bear just moseying on across the street. I was like, oh, that's so cool. The first black bear I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I love seeing them. The first several that I saw were in around Mena on Rich Mountain. Mm-hmm. Going up the, you know, the Tallahena Drive, and you know, there's a highway that goes up real scenic view and whatnot. And I'd ride my motorcycle over there, and I'd see them crossing the road or walking down the side of the road several times before I actually, I mean, I saw several across the road before I ever saw one in the woods. And then, it's hard to see them in the, it's a lot harder to see them in the woods than just crossing the road or out in some big field. You know, you might be able to see them across there, kind of on the edge of it. We had one go come right across my driveway. I've got a picture of him in front of my trash can last year. Yeah. Last spring. And I've got goats there. I've got a whole farm. And, so I like seeing him, but I was also a little, I'm like, am I going to see him again? And other folks around the area saw him, but never back real close back to my place. I never had any issues with him or anything.
Gotcha.
So, yeah. Yeah.
That's so cool. Yeah. I went and backpacked, you know, I think we went 6 miles or something like that over there at the Cossetot.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I know that's bear country over there. And I was hoping so bad to see one, but we didn't see any while I was there.
Yeah. 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 That is, that's definitely bear country. I've seen several. Or several that I have seen are also from right back over in that way.
Really?
Yeah, that's good.
That's awesome. Yeah. So how do people get a hold of y'all and, you know, book trips or just find out information about y'all?
So we have a website. We're not great at keeping up on it. It's not super up to date. It's relatively up to date. It's, I don't want to throw my sister under the bus. She's in charge of that. We don't pay for a higher end website, so it doesn't have the bells and whistles that we can adjust as easily and whatnot. But you know, we have stuff there to kind of keep you posted. It has our email on it and our social media accounts, whatever. That's snakemountainpatgoats.org. But otherwise, all the main social media is Instagram, TikTok, and then our biggest one is Facebook. Most of the stuff we do is off of Facebook. Okay. So that's Snake Mountain Pat Goats. On any of the social media platforms, you find us there, and we usually post there on Instagram and Facebook ahead of time, so folks can know, like 3 months from now, we're going to do, you know, the bear hunt or whatever it is. And then about a month out or 2 months out, we'll put it up. And for big game hunts, we're usually, it's a draw only. And, you know, sometimes we'll have 200 people put the name in the hat. We can only take five or six. But it depends what it is. Our non big game stuff is usually there, you know, whoever, it's considered first come, first serve. We usually can take 12 or so, and we usually don't book out or, you know, we don't turn anyone away. We try not to turn anyone away. So, most of our trips folks can hit. It's just like the bear hunt and some of the hog hunts that we have the issue with, making sure or we have the issue where we have to do the draw.
I see.
And then our email, you know, I do get randomly, you know, a lot of times it's somebody's, you know, it's a spouse and she's like, I heard about y'all, whatever. And can they go? Like, you know, if I get a random phone call and I see a voicemail and someone asking to be part of the project, then, you know, you don't have to be on social media. I know not everybody's into that. So any means necessary, they send me a carrier pigeon. I'll try to use that. So,
I'll make sure that I put your website in the description and, I'll throw some socials in there too. So for the listeners, if it's something you're interested in helping out with or being a part of, definitely go check them out. I think it's a great idea. It's something that I would have never thought of people doing. And, but it sounds like it's awesome and can be doubly therapeutic being outdoors and having the animals involved. So I just think it's a great thing that you're doing. And if there's anything that, you know, Jose or I can do to help y'all out, I mean, we'll happily do it.
Yeah. Well, y'all should come out sometime.
Yeah, that'd be fun. You got a trip coming up this weekend, don't you?
Yes, this coming weekend, and it depends on the water. You know, we've had so much rain that the water levels may be difficult for wading. And if we can't wade, it's not going to be much fun to fish where we, where we're going. Right. It's possible they come down. So if they come down and we think we're going to be okay, then we're going to do a fly fishing, smallmouth bass focused, you know, fishing trip, with Steven as our guide and our guru. If that doesn't work out, then we're going to go to, we're probably going to go to Horsehead Lake with a bunch of canoes and just go. We've got a lease over there that we have access to. So at least we can, you know, get people out there fishing. So not what we were planned for, but, I mean, the weather, it does not want to stop raining. So
yeah, it's been nonstop. And I was talking to one of my buddies up there, from Ozark Media up there in Northwest Arkansas. And we're talking about smallmouth fishing up there. And he said that everything's just basically blown out and muddy. So it's tough for smallmouth fishing. He said, but he's hoping this weekend or by next week that it'll clear up a little bit. So
yeah, I've never had much success. My style of fishing, I think, is not conducive for when the water is chocolate milk, you know? I know you can still catch them, but I usually don't do as well. I usually need a little bit of normal coloration pattern before I start running into them. Steven probably could get after them regardless, but if we can't wade, then it's not going to be much fun. So Well, we've got a plan A and a plan B.
That's awesome. Well, y'all be safe out there and y'all have fun. And it's been a pleasure having you on. We're kind of coming up on our time, so we got to close her out. But I feel like there's plenty more we can talk about. So if you ever want to hop on a future episode, talk about anything else, because it sounds like you have a lot more up there in that noggin. We'd love to have you on.
Yeah, I can yap about this kind of stuff for sure. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome, man. Well, we appreciate you hopping on. And for the listeners that made it to the end, we'll catch y'all next time.
This has been Wildlife Outdoors. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Facebook at Wildlife Outdoors and on Instagram at wild.life.outdoors. Let's go live life on the wild side.